Hi, everyone. Last week, we left you with Sonny Mercurio and Richie Floramo being set up for possession of $23 million worth of stolen securities.
And running massage parlors.
And here's the irony. The securities were just a run-of-the-mill charge. The massage parlor case, however, was the first RICO case in Massachusetts.
That is correct. And since Sonny and Floramo would become famous, or, well, infamous for their roles in the 1989 Mafia induction ceremony in Medford, Mass., we thought it would be a good idea to discuss the Mafia induction ceremony of 1977.
And we are never going to get out of the 70s.
Hey, you're the one taking us back to 1976 next week, so you're just as guilty as I am.
I'm not accusing you of anything.
Uh-huh, okay. Well, moving on, because this episode is going to be a long one, let's answer one question.
And what one do we have?
Another question from David. He asked, so could Sonny Mercurio have been giving up information about the LCN figures like Larry Bayoni and the Angelos before he did time in jail? And I'm assuming that's the second, this most recent bid that we discussed, not the original.
Yeah, not the original murder case, no. I suspect he was feeding the feds dribs and drabs of probably mostly useless information on the guys. I don't think he gave them anything serious, and I think that's why he ended up getting the sentence that he did.
Yeah, probably. I don't think they was giving them anything of substance until he was back on the streets. That stretch he did was likely a large part of what incentivized him later.
I agree that it was at least part of it. Did you submit the FOIA request for Sonny yet?
No, not yet. We gotta, maybe we can do it through the other program, not just straight.
Oh, through Muckrock.
Muckrock,
yeah, that would
might
be interesting.
Better to do.
And I'll do this one since you've done the last couple. All right. I want to give a disclaimer, though, before we start. There was really only one source of information about the induction ceremony that took place on October 5th, 1977. And that was Antonino Nino Cucinotta. It was made public during his testimony in 1995 when he turned state's evidence. Prior to that, it was alluded to in other court cases and news articles, but no specifics were ever provided.
It's so odd. And it's odd that they did it at 98 Prince Street and not 95.
I know, and I don't know if that was just a typo from the transcripts, but I saw the 98 number in several places.
They owned that block or something. I'm not disputing that. I just, you know, 95 was, I think, wasn't that where the wiretap was?
Yeah, and that was the quote-unquote doghouse. Didn't the father have a fruit store or something? Or something?
I think so. I guess what we're trying to say is they knew that it happened, but they didn't have any access to other information.
I'm not trying to say that what Cucinotta said wasn't true or accurate, but there are definitely some questionable statements that were made, which we'll get into in a bit. Plus, he suffered a serious head injury in 1988 and was under professional care for depression and other mental health issues, at least from the following year on.
Yeah, there were definitely issues there besides the normal run-of-the-mill antisocial behavior stuff.
No doubt. The others allegedly made that day at 98 Prince Street were Raymond Patriaca Jr., Rudy Sciarra, Bobo Marapizzi, Matthew Louis, good looking? Or was it Luigi?
I guess in theory it would be Luigi, because Luigi was the grandfather's name.
Okay.
Anyway.
So Matthew L., good looking, Guglielmetti Jr., Nicola, Nick, the Zip, Leonardo, William, Billy, Blackjack, Del Santo, and Pasquale, Pat the Piece, Galea. And I'm sorry if we butchered anyone's names, forgive us. And the masters of ceremony were Gennaro Jerry Angiulo and Joseph J.R. Russo.
Okay, so before we discuss the ceremony itself and the participants, I want to address the big question that I am sure many of our listeners will have. I know I was curious about this at least. Why was Raymond Patriaca Sr. not at this momentous occasion?
I was talking to myself as usual when I was researching this episode. Every journo and author said that Raymond was in the can. He was not in jail. He was on parole and was in court trying to get an injunction against the government to not release any more of the 302s from the wiretap at the Coin-O-Matic.
Plus, the feds had him under round-the-clock surveillance. He would have been picked up along with the rest of them.
And remember, Larry Bioni wasn't in attendance either.
Yeah, Larry, who supposedly sponsored little Joe Napolitano to be made. But wasn't Larry on trial that year?
That's right, the gambling case with A.B. Sarkis, plus he had a heart attack in June or July of 77.
Yeah, we haven't even scheduled that episode.
Add it to the spreadsheet before we get to Howie Winter. There's no turning back at that point.
Howie's never going to make it to Leavenworth at this rate.
Well, at least not in our story.
Well, there's no way Larry could have been present. Okay, so now that we got that out of the way, let's talk about the boys. And you need to tell the story of how Jerry and Julo got made.
I'll get to it.
Okay, sounds like a plan. So three of the inductees, Cucinotta, Galea, and Leonardo, were born in Italy. The others were locals. So let's talk about the native Italians first, then Del Santo, and then Guglielmetti and Marapizzi. And we've discussed Rudy Sciarra in multiple different episodes, so we'll try to keep it brief on him, and then we'll link to previous episodes for people who want even more details.
That makes perfect sense.
Okay, I just have one little teeny tiny favor to ask.
Okay.
Can you not stick me with Cucinotta's bio?
As I already mentioned, he had mental health issues starting in 1988. At first, I thought the whole crazy thing was an act like Vincent the Chin Gigante parading around his bathrobe, but he truly was out there.
You read more of the transcripts than I did, so I'm not going to argue with you there.
I feel like you just baited me and set me up somehow.
An innocent kid like me? Never would I ever do something like that.
You know, people think you're all the sweet one and the innocent one, but they have no idea about you elbowing, pushing people through your ways at the subways in Tbilisi.
Hey, if you can't beat them, join them. Those were the days.
Yeah, they were. Okay, enough of our trip down memory lane. Time for Antonino Nino Cucinotta's story. Nino was born on January 1st, 1942 in Sicily. Like Pasquale, he had one parent who was born in the States, but who returned to Sicily, married, etc., before returning back to the United States. In Nino's case, his mother was born in Pennsylvania. The family moved to the States, Rhode Island to be specific, in 1961. Nino and his brother both worked as butchers, Nino from the age of 8, and he claimed to only have a fifth grade education. Now, for the first bit of controversy, several writers have said that Nino was imported to do a hit for Raymond. Did Raymond really need to bring a 19-year-old kid and his family off the boat to knock someone off?
Who else did they try to say? I mean, he tried to import. Didn't they say that about somebody else, too, that he imported somebody?
They did, and when I was putting all this together, I was trying to think of who that was, and I couldn't.
Okay, well, anyway, but it makes no sense. That rumor was started with Special Agent William Shea of the FBI when, 3 decades later, he reported to the local police that, quote, Cucinotta was brought over from Italy years ago to do a hit for Raymond, and after the hit, he became a married man and Junior's driver, unquote. The same story was told by Shea to Luigi Reale?
Reale, yeah.
A former Rhode Island statey. First, the only wise guy who was killed in Rhode Island during 61 or 62 was Jackie Nazarian on January 17th, 1962. I don't think Nino killed Nazarian. And speaking of Nazarian, here is a little fun Rhode Island mafia fact. Nino was the brother-in-law of John George Chikuyan, and the Chikuyans were related to Jackie Nazarian, but on the Italian side, not the Armenian side, like you would think.
Who wasn't related or linked to Nazarian?
Or the Beccaris.
True, and we're not going to go down either of those rabbit holes today. Okay, Nino always said he met the Patriarchas for the first time in 1975 and would try to portray himself as the reluctant mobster and gentleman gangster who wound up in the life by sheer accident. According to his version of events, he started hanging around the Coin-O-Matic in order to make money selling sandwiches and drinks at the Bradford Club, which was above the Coin-O. The grub kept the gamblers playing longer than usual, and Junior started giving him a small cut of the winnings. Nino did not become Junior's driver until 1981, some 4 years after the duo was supposedly made.
And that brings us to discrepancy number two. Nino testified in 1995 that he helped Junior Patriarca, quote, make his bones, unquote, by helping him to kill a guy named Johnny Carr in either 1975 or 1976. Okay, go ahead. I know you're jumping at the bit over there.
There was no one named Johnny Carr, Jonathan Carr, or John Carr, with or without an H, that was killed or went missing in the United States, forget about Rhode Island or Massachusetts, in 1975 or 1976. And you killed someone and you don't remember when.
But look at Johnny Mataruno and Stevie Flemmy.
Well, don't get me going. I went all the way back to 1961 saying to myself, well, maybe the feds weren't lying.
Talk about naive.
Well, I had a look, and besides, if there was a homicide or at least a missing persons report, don't you think the authorities would have tried to charge Junior?
Yeah, I just think that Junior was made in a nod to Raymond, don't you?
Oh, for sure, and Raymond made Jerry, and Jerry hadn't killed anyone either, according to the legend.
Okay, tell the story already. I'm sure most of our listeners know it, but some might not. I didn't.
Okay, the story goes that Larry Bione was shaking down Jerry during the 1950s. Larry was a made guy, so there was nothing that Jerry could do except pay him. Finally, Jerry had enough, and in the late 1950s, he stuffed 50 grand into shopping bags and made the journey to Providence to see Raymond. The payment was accepted, along with a pledge to kick up another $100,000 a year after that. Jerry and his brothers were made, and Larry Bione became a capo under Jerry. And we'll get into that dynamic and the aftermath of all of that in the beginning of season three.
Well, the bottom line is that Junior likely didn't kill anyone in order to be made, and neither did Nino Cucinato, but it makes me think of the Michael Francesi situation.
Yeah, when everyone brings that up about him being made and not killing anyone, he kind of alludes to the same thing. Okay, we went way off track as usual. Let's stick with the events up to and around 1977 and save the 80s and beyond for future episodes.
Okay, so let's move on to Pasquale Galea, who was named after his paternal grandfather. He was born in Calabria, Italy, in March 23rd, 1942, to Teresa Tricomi and Giovanni Galea. As Laura mentioned earlier, his father was born in the U.S., New York to be exact, but moved to Italy before the start of World War II. Galea was one of six children, including a brother who became a doctor and ran away to Anchorage, Alaska.
Another one. Do you blame him?
No. They arrived in the States in 1955 when Pasquale was 13.
So Pasquale was the first of our Italians to arrive in Rhode Island?
Yes. The order was Pasquale, Nino, then Nicola. And he fit in perfectly. He was a pallbearer at Jackie Nazarian's funeral, along with Anthony Beccari in January of 62. The following January, Pasquale testified, along with three others, that they had attended a party at Jackie's house 2 weeks before he was killed. He stated that Jackie was brandishing a revolver and that Rudy Sciarra had taken the gun away from Nazarian with his left hand, and that was why Rudy's fingerprints were on the gun, which police would later say was the weapon that killed Jackie and that matched two of the slugs pulled from Jackie's body.
In the end, no one was ever convicted of Nazarian's murder. In March of 65, Pasquale was arrested along with William Maffeo, Rudy Sciarra, Bobby Fairbrothers, and six others on gambling charges. He enlisted in the Army, and in 1969, he saw combat in the Vietnam War, receiving a Purple Heart. He never married and was highly respected by all. In 2015, he passed away unexpectedly of a heart attack. But there will be more about Pasquale later this season and next season.
Absolutely. Okay, let's move on to Nino Cucinato's best friend, Nicola Leonardo. He was born on September 29th, 1940,
Pietra Millara, Caserta, Campania, Italy.
There you go. To Vincenzo Leonardo and, oh my gosh, you're going to have to pronounce mom's last name too, Agatha Santanasio. Okay.
Well, we didn't butcher either of those.
Thanks. Anyway, Nicola came to the States alone in 1965. Like Galea, he never married, nor did he have any children. And he didn't have much of an early record. He was fined for speeding in July of 65, which, who hasn't done that? So, whatever. Anyway, things got a bit more dramatic in February of 73. While robbing Vincent E. Dolan and Daniel A. Jamgosian, Nicola was shot in the neck and hit in the head with a hammer. I'll go past 77 this time. In March of 82, he was arrested on marijuana charges and released on $2,000 bail. Then, a decade later, he was pinched with 7 pounds of marijuana. Nicola died on April 9th, 2001, in a hospital in North Providence.
Yeah, I thought it was okay to wrap Nicola up there since he's really not going to be making too much of a comeback. Okay, next on the list is William Del Santo. He was born on November 13th, 1943, to Carmine Del Santo and Anna Maria, and I'm going to butcher this one, Scadoni.
Hey, glad you had to try to pronounce that one, not me.
Well, I tried. The first arrest of Williams I could find was in March of 1962, and he had two others. He and two others were arrested for robbing a coin shop in Natick, Mass.
Why is there always a coin shop or a stamp shop?
They were super popular back in those days. Anyhow, the total haul was a mere $300, but bail was set at $10,000 each. Nothing ever came of the case. I have to bring up the alleged Johnny Carr hit again. According to another source, Del Santo was also considered a suspect in the Johnny Carr homicide.
But who was Johnny Carr? Maybe John, maybe Caruso, and they're, butchering the last name?
But nobody was...
Okay. I'm just trying to come up with other...
We just did the hit parades of 75 and 76. But think about it. We just did those episodes, and we did a lot of research on those. Did you come across a name that was even close to that?
No.
So to me, it's another example of intel laundering.
Yeah, the only Johnny Carr I know was the British comedian, so I got nothing. Okay, but one more thing about William. He was related to the Blue Jay, Carl Valeca, by marriage.
We still need to do our jail episode, but now let's make a decision about William, a.k.a. the Loan Shark Wizard. I have a lot of things I want to cover about William's adventures, but they're all after the ceremony, so I think that we should wait until we do the Federal Hill episodes.
I agree, or we'll never finish this episode, and I want to get to Junior Patriarch.
Junior and Matthew and Rudy and Bobo.
Okay, so Raymond Joseph Patriarca was born on February 24th, 1945, to Raymond Ellis Patriarca and Helen G. Mandela in Providence, Rhode Island. And we told his parents' romantic wedding story in an earlier episode that Laura will link to.
Yes,
so,
we have lots of links.
I will spare you the long list of nicknames, and we'll just stick with Junior to avoid confusion. I have to include this one blurb from the wiretap at the Coin-O-Matic between Raymond and Junior. Quote, "Marry an Italian girl. She'll stand by you when you're in trouble and won't call the police if you slap her in the mouth." Unquote.
Junior, years later, would deny that conversation ever took place and that it was a fed fabrication. He told the press, quote, "My father never, never, never told me about getting women, Italian women, bothering women. I want to apologize to all the people in the state of Rhode Island because my father never had a conversation with me like that about women, marrying an Italian girl so you can hit an Italian girl. He never spoke to me like that. In fact, my first wife was Jewish and my stepmother is Irish. My father respected all women." You know, I believe him.
Yeah, good for him for standing up for the him, for himself and his dad. But I have another Rhode Island Mafia fun fact.
Tell.
Junior had a driver's license with no photo, and in the spot where the photo should have been, it said, "Valid without photo," unquote.
I wonder what that was, what was that all about? I don't know if he... I mean, everyone knew who he was visually. You would spot him. I mean, if the police pulled him over or whatever, it's not like he didn't know who he was. What, is that a vanity thing?
I guess. I don't know. Anyhow, he went off to college, even though he didn't finish. He married his first wife in the mid-60s. When the Italian-American Civil Rights League was at its peak, before Joe Colombo was shot, he gave office space to them.
The interesting thing to me is that after Junior got married, Raymond Sr., and Thomas Hillary were living together in a one-bedroom apartment until 1970 went to jail.
Junior supposedly brought Tommy Hillary home with him when they were teenagers, and he lived with them all those years, and then Hillary took care of Helen Patriarca after she got cancer.
I remember that you think that Hillary was Raymond's illegitimate kid.
Hey, it's possible, and it makes just as much sense as anything else.
I agree with you. You're not going to get an argument. And now, in order to save time and everyone's sanity, let's save Junior's full story when we cover his trial.
Okay, now let's move on to Maddie next.
Okay, another name that I'm going to butcher, and I'm not going to even try to say it the Italian way. I'm just going to say it the Rhode Island way as best as I can. Matthew L. Guglielmetti Jr. was born on October 31st, 1948, to Matteo Matthew L. Guglielmetti and Gloria V. Cicciarelli, in Providence, Rhode Island. His dad was a truck driver and a teamster. His paternal grandfather was from Piacenza in the Emilia-Romagna region of Italy. He had a record dating back to 1970 when he was arrested on marijuana charges, but the case was dismissed in December of that year. Then 5 years later, he was arrested with Blaise Mafio for possession of an illegal handgun. His engagement to Diane Ogden was announced in December of 1977, just 2 months after the induction ceremony.
Well, let's wrap him up here because he's still kicking, and we'll be doing an in-depth profile of him when we cover the induction ceremony of 1989 at the end of this season, and even more in season 3. And that brings us to Bobo Marapesi.
And you get to start this one.
Oh, gee, thanks. So Frank Luigi Bobo Marapesi Jr. was born on March 29th, 1943, to Frank Luigi Sr. and Margaret De Cristoforo in Cranston, Rhode Island. He was one of three children. His paternal grandfather was from Falciano, and his maternal grandmother was from Florence. His father faced charges ranging from putting sugar in the gas tanks of cars when he was a teenager to bilking local banks out of small loans. He was also the first cousin to Alfred Lepore, who was killed in 1975, and we covered that in the Hit Parade of 1975. Bobo married in August of 63. From 62 to 65, he had a string of minor motor vehicle violations, but in August of 66, he was charged with assault with intent to kill his wife and in-laws after a heated argument with his wife. When her parents saw him attacking her with a wooden table leg in the front yard and intervened, Bobo proceeded to threaten to kill all of them.
How charming. In March of 67, Bobo was fined for carrying a concealed weapon. The following year, in August, he was involved in a bar brawl that led to his arrest, but he failed to appear in court, so a bench warrant was issued. In November that year, he was arrested again, but released on $1,000 bail. Not one to rest on his laurels, he was arrested again in January of 1969 for robbing the Columbus National Bank on Atwell's Ave in Providence of $2,105. And the money was recovered within a matter of, 4 or 5 hours. And the only thing that was missing was between him and the cohort, they somehow spent $38. Once again, though, he was given bail and released on a $3,500 surety bond.
I know we gripe about this all the time, but how do you keep getting bailed like that?
Well, you know, in a normal world, the first bail would have been revoked. And I know I defend it because I say, oh, the records weren't computerized and all of that. But in his case, he was in the same courthouse all the time.
Probably knew him by sight. This guy again.
Sure. Again and again and again.
Anyhow, the barroom brawl charges were dismissed in June of 69. Then in August, he was pinched for stiffing a Warwick Motel for a room.
And I don't even want to know what that was about.
Yeah, but didn't Richie stiff a hotel once?
Yeah, the Westin Hotel at Copley Place, but the tab was $47,000.
Okay, well, we'll save that story for another day. But my favorite Bobo story was when Sabu the lion escaped out of his mother's yard later that summer. The poor thing was found hiding behind a trash can not far from the house.
You'd run away, too.
Who keeps a lion in their yard?
I don't know. They said it was sweet and kind, and they had it on a chain.
Oh, dear. Anyway, a couple of months later in October, he was acquitted on charges that he was driving a vehicle with a stolen license plate that was Bobo, not Sabu the Lion, by the way. In January of 70, the assault with intent to kill charges were also dismissed. Later that year, he was arrested for selling beer without a license at the Acorn Club.
Well, that was a spicy one.
Well, the spicy one was in March of 72 when he received a 3-year and a 6-year suspended sentence plus 8 years probation for receiving a stolen camper.
I think it was a little more elaborate than buying a hot camper.
Yeah, the charges do sound a bit comical.
Okay, now for something a bit more dramatic. In early May 1974, Bobo was charged with illegal possession of a machine gun and then went AWOL. He was arrested later the following month, but only after the cops had chased him up a tree. The following year in March, he was subpoenaed over the Cali murder. I'll link that episode also because, well, it's the same episode from 75. I want to give one thing post-induction ceremony here. In June of 1978, Bobo was sentenced to 5 years in prison for violating the terms of his probation from the stolen camper case.
Okay, we'll leave the rest of Bobo's story for another episode. And now, last but not the least, Rudy Sciarra. Like we said at the beginning, we've done numerous episodes that have covered Rudy, so we will keep it short, but we'll link to all these other episodes.
And let's skip the genealogy and focus on his record up to 77, please.
Okay, Rafferty's record went back to 1939 when he was arrested in Massachusetts for stealing a car. To add to his misery, in October of that year, he escaped and fled to Rhode Island, only to find himself arrested on a fresh auto charges and shipped off to Howard. But the charges were dropped later that month. In October of 42, Angelo DeSaro, the uncle of future murder victim of Frankie Salemi, were arrested for stealing booze from the West Exchange warehouse back in April of 41. Rudy enlisted in the army in March of 43, I assume to escape a jail, another jail sentence.
That was very common back in those days, or the judge highly recommended it.
I think they still do that.
Probably. At the end of World War II, Rudy remained in the service, but visited his home in Providence when he could. He was arrested on September 1st, 1946, by the Rhode Island State Police for being at an illegal gambling establishment. That stunt would land him in the U.S. disciplinary barracks in Cumberland, Pennsylvania, to serve a two-year sentence. He was discharged from the service upon completion of his bid and headed back to Providence. By 1950, he had been pinched for assault and battery, followed by another arrest for having brass knuckles in his possession, playing craps on a Sunday, and to end the decade in style, he was arrested on drug charges in April of 1959.
As we mentioned earlier, Rudy was charged with the murder of Jackie Nazarian. Thanks to the testimony of Pasquale Galea and other factors, he was exonerated of the charges. In June of 65, he faced federal gambling tax charges, to which he later pleaded guilty. In 1967, he was charged with the murder of Willie, only to be acquitted.
Remember, Willie was also charged with Nazarian's murder, but the authorities could never get an indictment. Rudy was cleared, and like the Nazarian murder, no one was ever convicted. In April of 1968, he, and it feels to me like half of Federal Hill, was arrested for plotting to shoot Joe Schiavone. Then on August 15th, 1969, he was arrested in the slaying of Rudy Maffio and Anthony Millay. The following March, he was found guilty of conspiracy to commit murder and sentenced to 10 years, but he would be a free man by the time of the ceremony.
Okay, we're finally to the ceremony, but before we start, I want to mention that the surveillance report from the Coin-O-Matic on that same day, October 5th, 1977, a lieutenant with the Rhode Island State Police reported to the feds that Patriarca would go to sit at the Coin-O-Matic nearly every day. 2 days previously, he had seen Raymond Patriarca sitting in someone's car behind the building having a conversation. I mention all of this to verify once again that Raymond was not in prison when the ceremony took place.
Thank you. And again, I want to say that Nino Cucinato was the sole source of information about the ceremony. According to his version of events, the group set out from Providence in two cars and met at an espresso bar in the North End. I tried to find out if it was the Cafe Pompeii or the Florentine, but no luck. If any of our listeners know, please write to us.
After the cafe, they went to 98 Prince Street, which was the headquarters of Jerry Angiulo. And I want to point out again that Nino said that Rudy, Nicola, and he were brought in and walked past a group of people sitting at tables and then escorted into a private room. One by one, they were led out. He did not mention Junior, William, Matthew, Pasquale, or Bobo.
Well, at least not in the testimony that we could find. Nino said that he sat across from Jerry and the process began. Quote, Nino, do you know why you're here? Angiulo said. Do you have an idea? Nino said he did. Quote, you're here because you're going to be baptized, Angiulo said. You were baptized when you were a baby and you're going to be baptized tonight. You're going to be a man. Angiulo proceeded to ask Nino a series of questions.
Let's say that you have a brother, and this brother of yours, you know, he becomes a rat, and he tried to hurt our organization or one of our friends. If we would tell you to kill your own brother, would you kill your own brother? Nino said yes. And Julio posed a second question. Well, let's say your mother is very sick, and she's in bed dying, and let's say that the telephone will be ringing, and that will be us. Would you come to see us? Would you leave your dying mother in bed and come to see us? Again, Nino said yes.
Jerry proceeded with the ceremony by placing a picture of the Madonna in Nino's hand and set it on fire. Nino took an oath, quote, if I ever reveal the secret, I would be out of here dead, end quote. Then J.R. Russo lit a needle, pricked Cucinato's finger, and kissed him.
a needle. What did he have, a splinter? I thought the trigger finger was supposed to be a cut with a knife.
Hey, that's what I thought too, but what do we know? The needle thing gave me all kinds of flashbacks, by the way, of all those splinters I had after I'd have been climbing trees. My tribe had me all paranoid that if I left a splinter in there, it would go straight to my heart, that you'd be able to trace the line under your skin while it was happening and watching yourself die.
You're lucky you don't have anxiety.
Please, I'm lucky that I'm alive. All right, now back to the ceremony. Nino said that a group of wise guys entered the room and congratulated him. It was official. Nino was a made member of the Mafia.
Okay, I am glad that's over, but we'd love to hear from you guys about what you've heard about the ceremony.
And sorry it was such a long one. It was another broken promise on both of our parts this time. Okay, next week we will be back with the Danvers Armory heist of 1976.
And that one's going to be a little bit different. We're going over to Ireland and the IRA and the British soldiers and all kinds of fun stuff.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Bye.